Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about the Time magazine story, The War for China's Soul as Christianity Begins to Reshape the Nation. Time learns new details about a crackdown on one church. We're going to talk about Christianity in China. It's a big, big country. Now, its government is communist and officially atheist. We hear a lot about the persecution of cults like Falun Gong in China. How do Christians fare? What's it like to be a Christian in that communist nation? Dr. Henry Rowald joins us here for the next half hour. He's missions professor of practical theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, formerly served as a missionary to Taiwan, and as director of the China Coordinating Center for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Dr. Rowald, welcome to Issues Etc. Dr. Rowald, are you there?
I am.
All right. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I'm happy to be part of this.
Let's deal with just the basic issue that I think most people may misunderstand. Is Christianity legal in China?
And the simple answer is yes, it is. It is one of the five major religions officially recognized by the government of China, and that is Roman Catholicism and Protestant Christianity. Those are two of the five, plus Buddhism, Taoism, and Islam.
What does it mean to have that official recognition by the government of China?
That means that the church can function openly in society. It can own property. It can hire people. It can function in ways that the various religions function. In that sense, it is a very open form of presence.
Then what's it like to – someone might surmise from what you said there – that perhaps being a Christian in China is kind of like being a Christian in America, just the names are different or something like that. Is there a one-for-one comparison there? If it has official recognition by the government, is everything peachy keen for Christians in China?
Peachy keen would likely not. I don't even know how you say that in Chinese. For one thing, one major difference is that Christianity is not a recognized religion by the government of the United States. The government is not in the business of recognizing religions. That already says that there are some implicit restrictions built into that status. And those restrictions are very important. Officially, the restrictions are maybe not as bad as sometimes the headlines would seem to indicate. Unofficially, however, there's a lot of unevenness in the way the official policies are put into effect. So, no, it is not the same thing being a Christian in the United States as being a Christian in China.
What are the basic numbers that we're dealing with here? How many Christians do we estimate live in China?
That is a matter of great debate. Article we're talking about lists the number of 65 million, at least it says some experts say, and that may not be far off. It may be just a little bit optimistic. One of the problems is, what do you mean by Christian? Are you talking about a matter of someone who has a bit of faith, those who come to church, those who are baptized? We're talking about communicant members. You can see there's a lot of slipperiness, and in addition to which, a lot of Chinese just are not interested in having their names on a list, thank you. And so some of the estimates are unreasonably low, and some of them, I think, are optimistically high. I would put a guess somewhere between 40 and 60 million.
So that would still be in single digits in terms of the percentage of the population.
That is true. Now, that population is pretty large, so the brute numbers are still pretty overwhelming.
Let's say at the high end, 60 million Christians would be significant any place else, of course. That's a lot of Christians. There are only 77 million Anglicans worldwide. So,
well, and not only that, when Christianity went into the communist era, estimate was maybe a million Protestants, maybe not quite a million Roman Catholics, 2 million tops. And that church went into heavy persecution. And during the Cultural Revolution in the early 60s, it was stamped out. There was no visible form of the Christian church. for that to come to 40, 50, 60 million is an incredible miracle.
How much of that church is, while Christianity is officially recognized in its both Protestant and Catholic forms, how much of the church would we say, at least from our vantage point, operates underground in China?
That's awfully hard. That's just a hard thing to answer. In my mind, I distinguish three forms of the Christian church in China. One is the registered church. I think that's the most neutral way of talking about it. The registered church that is officially registered and therefore sanctioned. At the far other end is the underground church, which is kind of an anti-church, anti-registered church, and anti-communist government. And I think the large majority is in the middle, in rural areas, and goes under the rubric of house church. Some of them are registered. Some of them are much closer to the underground. Most of them are just simply un. They just operate in their village, which doesn't have much to do with other villages. And it's just kind of un.
You read the story from Time magazine where at least one church has experienced what the magazine is calling a crackdown. The circumstances seem to surround the building of a church facility. What's your reaction to this?
Well, from a government's point of view, the issue is that this is an unregistered body of people who are trying to provide for themselves formal long-term presence and, in fact, a building that they claim their own. And it doesn't fit in the way the government operates the nation. Therefore, from the government's point of view, the issue is not religious persecution. It is social stability. You can't have just anybody throwing up buildings. At another level, however, it is always the case that those government officials who begin a program like this often have their own agendas. Maybe they have some bitter experiences, or maybe they just have personal animosity to the church. And likely for a combination of reasons different in every situation, you end up with these unregistered churches paying some pretty heavy dues. And that was certainly the case in what looks like an immense project, a church to serve a community of 5,000 parishioners.
So the government views this as simply keeping order in the society, not allowing people simply to put up a building someplace. But, of course, can that be divorced from the kind of velvet glove of oppression that Christians live under in China?
Well, as I was trying to say, you can look at the same phenomenon from a lot of different perspectives. And from the church's perspective, given the history of the communist movement as it came to power and in the first 20, 25 years of its existence, intense persecution of the church, there is a level of great suspicion and intimidation involved in the hearts of the Christian people, with some good reason. From the government's point of view, the whitewash is that, no, this is purely a matter of helping society operate in upfront ways.
We're talking about the Time magazine story titled "The War for China's Soul." Dr. Henley Rowald is our guest. He's mission professor of practical theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He formerly served as a missionary to Taiwan and as director of the China Coordinating Center for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. What are the major obstacles, then, to further mission work in China, either from the outside or indigenous mission work being carried out by Christians who live in China?
Well, I'll be glad to answer that. I would like to speak also, before we're done, about some positive, even surprising developments of Christianity in China before we're through. In terms of obstacles, the major obstacle, as I see it, is that there is on the part of the government a systemic suspicion of religion of any kind. They see it as a parasite on society, something that sucks up money and energy on the part of people, and therefore the country is weakened in terms of its attempt to modernize. That makes the church marginal, not only on the part of the government, but on the part of the people of China whom the government educates. Church has no presence in the educational system of China. It is not allowed in the universities of China. It really has a hard time in a lot of places, even beginning a Sunday school for its own internal use. The restrictions are many, and they are simply there because of a government intent to make the church irrelevant and have it just wither up all from the inside.
But that doesn't appear to be happening.
It sure does not, and thank you for that lead-in to phenomena that are going on in China that just blow the mind. Let me just mention a few things. Feel free to interrupt if you want to pursue them. I was at a conference about a half year ago or so, not even, where a lot of these, I was updated on a lot of these things and even more surprised than I had been before. If there's a bottom line rubric for this, I think I would say this, that it's better and more accurate to talk about Christianity in China than about the Christian church in China. If that distinction makes any sense. And what I mean when I say that is this. Christianity in China is making a presence in the universities of China, where 10 years ago it would have been considered ludicrous and completely unrealistic to think that religion of any kind and Christianity as a religion seen as coming from the West to be talked about in scholarly terms, in a scholarly context. Anymore, there are probably 15 to 20 universities, flagship universities, offering graduate degrees in departments of religious studies of one kind or another. You could get a doctorate, believe it or not, in biblical studies in China, public state university. That means you've got Christian professors in China. In terms of my being in and out of China, I see things there now in the second generation of professors of religion in China. The first generation were people sort of interested, more from moral or aesthetic reasons. Second generation, a lot of very committed Christian professors. Who in turn lead study groups of little, gatherings of students on campuses in China. Unbelievable, even 10 years ago. Another phenomenon I was made aware of is the presence of Christian CEOs leading factories in China and having devotions as part of just the daily schedule. 300-plus of them was the statistic that I heard. That they don't all make it into a church, and that's why I distinguish Christianity from Christian church. They don't all make it into a church, but the Christian faith is being shared and it's being inculcated in very unique kinds of contexts. Christian literature, unbelievable amounts of Christian literature. There are, would you believe, 70-plus Christian bookstores operating around the country of China, some of them with branches which would make a number likely 150 to 200. And I've been in a few of them, unrelated to a specific congregation, and yet significant, very attractive, in fact, bookstores filled with Christian-related literature. Last word I heard is that the government is reconsidering the possibility of allowing the Bible, reclassifying the Bible from being an internal document meant only for Christians to a document of a significant cultural interest, which would allow it to be sold on in the open book markets. Aren't those some astounding phenomena?
It sounds like, as perhaps the history of the church itself would teach, that the Christian faith and the church thrive even, and sometimes even better, when in a hostile environment. There's a, in spite of all the restrictions that are there, it sounds as though I would call that thriving.
You bet. There are a couple of aspects to that. One is that usually when the church suffers, something's gone pathological with the society. And there are a lot of others besides Christians who suffer. And therefore, if the Christians can suffer with love or joy or hope, that speaks immensely to other people who, by and large, don't know how to make sense out of life. And for another thing, the Christian church has been purified in the sense that it knows exactly what it believes and why it believes it. And there are no mixed messages that are given.
So if you've watched these things for a number of years from both the Chinese perspective, the Taiwanese perspective, is it your judgment that things are markedly getting better, even though the restrictions are still there, things are markedly getting better for Christians in China?
Yes, indeed.
Do you expect it to continue?
I do. At the same time, the church is facing some internal challenges it has to deal with. One is church structure, at least in terms of the registered church, which is not terribly open to change. It has to provide leadership that needs to fill a gap of about 20 years in the Cultural Revolution when it could produce no leaders. And it needs to find a way to incorporate these Christian CEOs and these Christian professors and university students and students who come to the States or to Europe, become Christian, and then go back. Find ways to incorporate these new forms, these new appreciations of Christianity into the mainstream of the church. To the extent it can do that, it is one, I think, one of the few bodies out there that can provide an alternative to the purely materialistic, money-grabbing dynamic that's also very much alive there.
I wanted to talk a little bit about that in just a moment, if we could. Folks, if you have a question or a comment on Christianity in China, give us a call in the next 10 minutes, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio at issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Henry Rowald is our guest, and we're talking about Christianity in China. The major exposure that most people have to the goings-on in China has to do with what can only be called an unbelievable economic boon there. China is viewed as probably one of the principal markets for anyone who wants to do business in the world today, simply because of its population. And it's opened up its trade borders to accommodate that. And one wonders how long communism can survive in that case. But what I'm wondering about is, as it incorporates more and more Western values, you mentioned just a moment ago, kind of the money-grubbing materialism that goes along with a lot of that. How much of a challenge is that for Christians there in China?
You know, that's a challenge everywhere, and I don't know that that's necessarily that the Western culture has a monopoly on money-grubbing. China has been good at that for a long time, and in fact, the place of overseas Chinese in particularly Southeast Asian countries is always quite vulnerable because Malaysians, Indonesians, and other folks from other Southeast Asia countries see all of the money in Chinese hands. And every once in a while, there's just a horrid, bloody outbreak of resentment. And then things get back to normal again. So it's not a, I don't think that's a Western incursion at all. China will teach us a lot of things about that, actually. The question is this. China, both the government and the world of academia, are aware of the fact that communism as an ideology has dried up. It is bankrupt. And therefore, what is it that drives the morality that holds the humaneness of the Chinese people together? And there are two main players, and the government, I think, recognizes this. One is Confucianism. It's just that's sometimes so intellectual that it doesn't always filter down to the folk level. And the other is Christianity. The morality, the moral fiber, the moral salve of Christianity is appreciated by folks of a lot of levels, including government levels of China. Even Billy Graham heard that from government people on his last visit to China.
Let's take a quick phone call here as our time winds down. Steve from Fenton. Steve, thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. My original question I'd like to check on is, I'd heard there was only one officially sanctioned Bible version that was allowed over there, and anything else, such as the King James or the New American Standard or something, or anything like that, was forbidden to be brought in. And then also, but something else that you just said intrigued me. Do you really think that the party leadership over there has really given up on Marxism as a philosophical ideal?
Okay, those are two quick questions. We have very little time to answer them with about 30 seconds apiece. What do you know about the Bible version question, Dr. Rowald?
Well, Bible version is this. The Chinese counterpart to the King James Version, which when I was growing up was kind of the version that everybody respected and held in great affection, is the Chinese version of that is a union version that was done in 1919. Whether you're among Chinese in Taiwan or on the mainland or overseas Chinese, wherever they are, including the states, that generally is seen to be the accepted version or translation of the Bible.
And then the second question with less than a minute, what about the party leadership there being willing to part with Marxism eventually?
As a philosophy, I doubt it seriously. At the same time, there is not the same burning passion, that commitment to that there was, say, 20, 30 years ago. Chinese have learned to bend and to incorporate things into a different frame of view.
Dr. Henry Rowald is Mission Professor of Practical Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He served as a missionary to Taiwan and as director of the China Coordinating Center for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Dr. Rowald, thanks for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we're going to be halfway through the program, and we're going to start a conversation on American idols or America's idols. They're not necessarily something you carve out of stone and bow down to worship. They come in many different forms. Dr. Harold O.J. Brown of Reformed Theological Seminary will be our guest. Talk about that after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Paraphrasing that scripture that says, if my people will turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. Can we apply that to the United States of America? It's in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, and I put that question to Pastor Tom Baker earlier today. If you'd like to hear his answer from our Bible study program, tune in tonight for our repeat, 7:05 this evening.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AM 850 KFUO underwriter.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A study from the Department of Education saying that charter schools are underperforming compared to traditional public schools is old and unreliable. That's according to charter school proponents. The National Center for Education Statistics found that in 2003, fourth graders in charter schools were 5 to 6 points behind their traditional school counterparts. Steve Jordahl takes a look at the numbers.
Well, I put these two together so that I have an aisle in between.
School starts tomorrow in Connie DeGrazio's fourth grade charter school class. She taught in regular public schools for 16 years. This will be her third in charter schools, and she's never been happier.
We're a character school, and so our children are taught to be truthful and honest, to know what's right, to differentiate between right and wrong.
Critics of charter schools who are using this report should take a few classes. Even the Federal Commissioner of Education Statistics, Mark Schneider, says the data is old. There are now over 3,000 charter schools in the nation, and over a third of them were started after 2003.
The whole world has been transformed since that report was released.
But the statistics were valid in 2003. What happened? Charter school operator Rick Piercy says many charter schools start with kids who are already behind.
By the very nature, the children that come to charter schools are children who have either been disenfranchised or don't want to attend a school, and they make that move. It's only at fourth grade level, and of course those are sixth graders now, and what we'd want to know is how much growth they've made in that amount of time.
Piercy cited two studies in the last week that show charter schools are doing well and says more are on the way. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
As expected, the education establishment was trumpeting the study. The American Federation of Teachers said the study is proof that charter schools are not able to deliver on their promises. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO, join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. Well, Pastor Martin Luther had a problem with gossip and slander in the little town of Wittenberg. There wasn't much privacy back then, but in the 21st century, we Americans cherish and protect our privacy. Then again, our opinions about others may be posted all over the Internet, and we think that's a right, too. We'll find out about public rebuke of public sin with Paul Robinson on the next Living Jubilee.
You can delve into the mind of 16th century reformer Martin Luther with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, titled Luther's World of Thought. How did Luther's mentors and teachers influence him? How did the European class system and political climate help and hinder his reforming efforts? Find out with Luther's World of Thought. For more information, 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org. Luther's World of Thought, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month.
We were talking about idols earlier today in the first half hour of the program, and we were walking over some of that ground in 1 Corinthians 10, where Paul warns the Corinthians there about association and communion with the idols of Corinth. And in that case, of course, he was talking about real temples, physical temples with physical statues in them of gods. Now, someone says, we don't have any of that today. Especially in America, we don't have that today. But there's idolatry, and then there's idolatry. We're going to be talking about America's idols here in this half hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Harold O.J. Brown is professor of theology and philosophy at Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's editor of the Religion and Society Report, and he's authored an article in a recent issue of Religion and Society Report titled Idols. Dr. Brown, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
There are idols and then there are idols. Make the case, if you would, that just because I can't walk down the street and see a temple to Athena or Zeus or something like that, walk in and see the idol, that America still has its idols.
Well, of course, one of the things that you have to bear in mind is the concept of an idol. Even in antiquity, in pagan antiquity, many of the pagans did not think of the stone object as the god. They thought that it in some way represented God. The god was a spiritual figure somewhere off, and the idol, what we call the physical idol, drew your attention to him. But actually the concept of idling, of an idol, is something that is false in which we put our trust. And even in antiquity, they didn't usually put their trust in the stone, but in something false behind it, the image of a god who does not exist. And this, of course, is what we have in the United States. We have I didn't know whether to include the American Idol in our discussion. Yeah, but that in a way is kind of symbolic, because we have a great deal of emphasis that's put on this young man or young woman who wins the becomes the idol of the year, I guess. And it is, of course, a very much misplaced trust, even in that case. I mean, he's only a human being.
In your article, you allude to a famous statement by G.K. Chesterton, where he says, and I paraphrase as you do, that when man rejects the true God, the danger is not that he won't believe anything, but that he will believe anything and everything.
That he will believe anything. Not that he will believe nothing, but that he will believe anything. Yes, and of course, I think Solzhenitsyn, of course, not a Lutheran, not a Protestant, but Russian Orthodox, but said at Harvard many years ago, the trouble with the world is that people have forgotten God. I think he said men have forgotten God. And this, of course, rendered him politically incorrect, and he was never invited back.
Hmm.
You know, the thing that you have here, if you don't have the true God, you have an idol, and we have many contemporary idols. I did a lot of, I was very interested in New Mexico, you know, where they had the idols of the Aztecs, to whom they sacrificed thousands of human lives. But we also sacrifice human lives to things that we think are will somehow reward us. For example, I talk about democracy as an idol. Now, democracy is not a god. Democracy is actually a technique, but we are, it's a technique of governing or self-government. But we have placed so much trust in it, you know, that we are willing to go to war contribute many of our own soldiers' lives and costing the lives of countless others for a very vague purpose. If you said, for example, in Iraq, the purpose of the war is to defeat an enemy that is trying to destroy us in some way, that would be clear. But if the purpose of the war is to establish democracy, well, that's a little more vague.
So where is the misplaced trust? Let's deal with democracy specifically, since it's first on your list, Dr. Brown. Where is the misplaced trust? I heard today, tell me if this is what it sounds like or if it's something else. Heard today coming into work a little bit late, someone on talk radio talking about kind of the transformative power of democracy. If we could just get these young people in the Middle East to catch on to democracy, then it would transform that whole society. It would transform the whole Middle East. Almost sounded like they were talking about a religious revival, but they were talking about the democratic form of government.
Yes, and of course, democratic form of government is a little bit vague as to exactly what that means. Certainly what the early Americans had, the Founding Fathers, was not what we have today. It was quite different in many respects. But it did have the principles of freedom, you know, and the individual right to vote and things of that sort. But again, these are just techniques, you know. They are not, they can be used or abused. We can use them well or we can use them badly. And it would seem that after we gave the after we had the right to vote for the Palestinians, they immediately used it to elect the Hamas government, which is, of course, a very bad choice as far as we're concerned. So democracy is not a power, it's not a being that can somehow help people to do right. It is a function that they're granted. They're granted the opportunity to do things. The worst tyrant, well, not maybe not the worst if we count Stalin, but one of the worst tyrants of human history was Adolf Hitler, and he was elected. You know, he was elected by a democratic process. It's true he was a minority candidate at first, but that's been many of our presidents have been minority candidates, you know, and elected.
Someone's going to hear, you know, the things you said about the present war, and they'll say, but wasn't something like the Second World War, wasn't that, again, a war to spread or to bring democracy where democracy was lacking?
Well, that was much clearer in the First World War, where Wilson... You know, I think most scholars would now agree that we didn't have a very strong casus belli, you know, reason to go to war against Germany in the First World War. But Wilson had the idea that this would make the world safe for democracy. And as you know, it did a terrific job. I mean, we wound up with Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, and so on. Before the war, we'd had emperors there, but now we had dictators. So it wasn't a better, it wasn't really that much of a change. And, in fact, it was a change in the wrong direction, I would say. One of my Austrian friends, now gone to be with the Lord, a very serious Christian who called himself an evangelical in the Catholic Church, you know, an interesting idea, but he said that democracy only works where people have a common idea of the good, a shared idea of the good. which I fear we no longer have. The Hamas, the voters for Hamas appeared to have a shared idea, but it wasn't the idea that we think is right. You know, so as the very fact that if people can choose does not in any way give any assurance that they'll choose what is right. So to put your trust in democracy is quite foolish.
You say that equality is also an idol in our society. How so, Dr. Brown?
Well, equality is really unreal. There's a very famous Reformed writer in the 17th century who pointed this out. He said the real goal should be fairness, not mandatory equality. If you say that all people are equal in any objective sense, other than equally, you know, created by God and the possibility of being the children of God, in that sense we are equal. But in any physical sense, we're not equal. I'm sure you're younger than I am. You can probably run faster, you know. Many of us are healthier. Many of us are less healthy. Many of us are brighter. Many of us are not so bright. You know, all of those things. We're equal only in the sense that we are equal in the sight of God. And so to talk about equality is very deceptive, and it usually results, as it has in the United States, if people don't turn out equally, we put in some legislation to make them equal, as, for example, affirmative action.
So specifically, beginning with that example, what evils have been wrought in the name of the idol equality?
Well, I think all sorts of things. I mean, for example, here in the local school system, we've eliminated a lot of the prizes that children could earn for, you know, doing well in various classes and so on, because it makes some of the other children know that they're not equal and therefore they feel bad. It really is a delusion to say that all human beings are equal, except in the sense that we should be equal in dignity in the sight of God. If we attempt to enforce it, it takes a lot of government power to enforce it. I'll give a little example. I ran in a couple of marathons in Chicago many years ago, and we had equality of opportunity, but we definitely didn't have equality of outcome. And if we had insisted that all the runners have to be equal, what would the government have had to do, or the people that ran, that have had to load some up with weights, give some of the others bicycles, you know, and perhaps a few of them motorcycles, in order to create equality of outcome. So the doctrine of equality have carried beyond the point of equality of opportunity, beyond the point of fairness, then requires tremendous efforts to manipulate society so that everything comes out equal.
We're talking with Dr. Harold O.J. Brown about America's idols. He's professor of theology and philosophy at Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's editor of the Religion and Society Report, and he's authored an article in a recent issue of that report titled Idols. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can also email a question or a comment to us right here in the studio. issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are coming to you live this Thursday. It's the 24th of August. Those phone numbers again, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Another idol that you list is tolerance, and it seems to go perhaps hand-in-hand with the one you just mentioned, equality. What is the idol of tolerance?
Well, there is a French writer who said this very well. You know, tolerance, when carried to an extreme, becomes the worst form of intolerance. Originally, tolerance was the idea that you would accept something that you didn't really approve of. But then it becomes not merely that you must accept it, but you must approve of it. And if you don't, and once you've approved of it, you probably have to establish it by law. And then in the long run, you might have to subsidize it. I mean, that's the case, for example, with so-called gay marriage. It used to be that a person who wanted to practice homosexual behavior normally tried to stay out of sight because he knew it would be unpopular. Then it began to be saying, well, we must be fair. That dropped the moral issue is what they're doing right. The social issue is what they're doing beneficial. They have to have the same right to express themselves in any way that the heterosexual would have. So tolerance becomes a kind of a rule for ruling out even telling the truth. As for example, I haven't experienced this myself, but one of my friends is a Canadian pastor, says in Canada, strictly speaking, tolerance means that you cannot denounce abortion or homosexuality from the pulpit because it interferes with the toleration of these things, and then of course means you can't tell the truth from a biblical perspective. One of the interesting things is all these demands for absolute equality. Everyone must be treated the same way from a certain perspective. Not all the runners in the marathon, of course. They must not end up together. But, you know, the concept of tolerance, as I say, carried to its extreme, becomes a very great form of intolerance. And you are not allowed to express the Word of God. You're not allowed to say what God says about certain attitudes, or certain behavior, because it might offend someone. And strange, it has strange variations. For example, in order not to offend people belonging to certain minority religions, you are not allowed to have any expression of Christian faith. Say, at the time of year we used to call Christmas, if you remember then. You're not allowed to do that in school. You're not allowed to do it publicly if you can possibly avoid it. But we must permit Muslims to say and do whatever they wish, because we must be tolerant. So that is a form of tolerance which has suppressed our freedom.
Why does that, picking up on that, why does Christianity seem to be kind of segueing into a discussion of pluralism, the only religious confession in our pluralistic, our religiously pluralistic society that is required to adhere strictly to this new or this hyper-tolerance, this rule of hyper-tolerance?
Well, there is a reason about that. Did not Jesus say, you know, do not be surprised when you're scorned and condemned by men? Because, of course, it is God's truth, and it is an unpleasant truth for people who don't accept it. You know, it's an unpleasant truth because behind it there is the suggestion that having failed to accept Christ, you will also fail to be saved. And so that's an unpleasant thought, and one of the ways to deal with it is to face the issue, you know, and see if you can see if you're convinced by the gospel. But the other way is to suppress it and not have it around, and you don't have to worry about it.
What becomes of the common conception of Jesus when Christianity is often held up to this? You know, Christians are supposed to be tolerant because Jesus was the most tolerant of all. He affirmed all people.
Did he?
And never argued with a single person, it is said.
Who says that? I mean, good heavens, you don't have to read much of the Bible. He spends a good deal of the time. Some of the people he argued most with were the, you know, the religious legalists of the Pharisees, who were not prepared to look upon him as the fulfillment of prophecy. But he certainly argues with everyone. He argues with the rich young ruler, you know, who didn't who wanted to be good, but nevertheless didn't want to sell what he had. That's all through the Bible. How can you? Jesus said, "I come to say, I bring a sword." First against mother-in-law and father-in-law and all that sort of thing. You know, there's certainly no. Jesus is not an example of tolerance. In fact, as has well been pointed out, if you want to talk about the ultimate sanction, which is of course hell. You know, the final destiny of people who reject Christ. If you talk about the ultimate sanction, who mentions hell most in Scripture? It's Jesus.
I was kind of tying together two things that you were just talking about, Dr. Brown. I was just reminded of, I think it's probably the United Churches of Christ. They have an ad campaign that's running on television in some cities, and I've seen this ad where I can't remember the details of the visuals, but the tagline is somewhere in the ad, a homosexual couple is asked to leave the church or something. And somewhere in the ad it says, Jesus never turned anyone away, neither do we. And they're kind of announcing the fact that if you are openly gay and happy with that lifestyle, then their church is the place to be. What do you make of this?
Well, first of all, I have seen that ad, and they imply conduct on the part of conservative Christians is probably not at all representative. You know, all Christian churches, I think, will accept repentant homosexuals. They will not accept on a regular basis people who continue to flaunt the fact that they are disregarding God's law and God's word. But in terms of people being poor and not being accepted or being sick or old, there were pictures like that. You know, surely Christian churches have been in the forefront of showing not merely tolerance, but acceptance, mercy, and help to people in that kind of distress. The ones that the UCC are worried about, the ones that church is worried about, are the ones that are violating the law of God, which may have some difficulty getting accepted in some churches. you know, most Christian churches do not make any effort to get rid, let us say, of unmarried couples living together. They want to witness to them and convince them that they should either marry or separate, but not just tell them you can't come here. That's kind of fictitious, isn't it?
So the ad is, first of all, attacking a straw man, and then second of all, presenting a picture of Christian tolerance that is, in fact, not in accord with God's word.
Well, you know, what did Jesus say? The last thing that he said, at least in the Gospel of Matthew, is teach them, you know, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them and teaching them to do whatever they please. Is that right? Surely not, you know, to observe whatever I have commanded you. Jesus was very, very strong on sexual morality. He commanded a lot of things that some of us have difficulty doing. I remember some years ago, I was involved in a certain amount of financial difficulty, and I spoke to a fellow Christian about lending me a bit of money for a short period. And he said, well, that would set a bad precedent. Well, didn't Jesus say, you know, some of the things Jesus asked us to do are quite difficult to do, and not every Christian will do them. But nevertheless, he doesn't tolerate everything.
Two final idols here. Pluralism, what is it? And then we'll talk finally about choice. But what is pluralism?
Well,
what do you mean by that?
There are two different ways of looking at pluralism. One is merely descriptive. You know, we're saying that in American society, we have a pluralistic society. We have many different groups of people, many different ideas that are all present, and their presence is accepted. So that's descriptive pluralism. Prescriptive pluralism is to say that all ideas are equal. All views are equally good, and that simply is nonsense. You know, you certainly can't say that, for example, if you're planning a bridge, that all views about the strength of material are equal. You have to get the one that's right, or the bridge will fall down. So prescriptive pluralism is definitely, it's a sort of a self, you almost say it should be self-reflected as idiotic, but prescriptive pluralism tries to prevent the Christians, as well as others, who have opposing views from expressing their views as true. This all views are equal, which means no view is true.
The final idol that you talk about is choice. How is this an idol?
Well, you know it all the time. I remember, you know, that very, very few people will say, oh, we favor choice. I mean, we favor abortion. Say we favor choice. Now, notice, though, that the choice doesn't have any content. If you go into a restaurant and they say to you, would like smoking or no smoking, and you say, well, I favor choice, what will they do with you? You know, choice has become a slogan that is used as a substitute for abortion. I favor the right to choose. To choose what? Well, we don't say what, but we know what, you know. So it covers the thing that people don't want to say. Very, very few people, not even President Clinton, not even Hillary Clinton, want to say that they favor abortion, but they favor choice, which is another way of saying we favor abortion. But all you need to do is to put it into other circumstances, and you'll see how foolish it is. For example, should, let us say, one group of people, let's for example take Jewish people, be excluded from a club? Well, the club has a right to choose, doesn't it? It can choose the people it accepts. Accept some, doesn't accept others. Do we accept that? No, we don't usually accept that. Surely some of the states of the old Union chose to accept slavery. And others didn't say, well, you have the freedom to choose. Have slaves if you want them. Don't if you don't. You know, it's a very empty concept, but in that particular case, it's taken to justify something that shouldn't be justified.
And then finally, with less than a minute, why do you think, with regard to that last idol, choice, that so few people see that it is a euphemism and that that precise same little verbal trick that's played there all the time when it comes to choice and abortion doesn't work and never would work, never would pass the smell test with regard to something like slavery? Why don't you think they see this, Dr. Brown?
Well, I think the answer to that, 2 Corinthians 4:4, now this is getting a bit theological, of course, but the God of this world has blinded the eyes of those who do not believe, and it goes on to say that they may not see the glorious light of the gospel. But if you're blind, you don't see a darn thing, you know? And it's very unusual that you'll find anyone whose eyes have truly been opened by the Scripture who will say, who will not see what we're talking about when we talk about freedom of choice. The basic problem is very, very deep. As Solzhenitsyn said, men have forgotten God. You know, what it says in Romans chapter 1, we do not recognize this God, neither are we thankful. It used to be that just as a matter of course in the United States, we had a regular celebration of Thanksgiving. You know, children would sing in school, come ye thankful people come, those old Thanksgiving songs. Now we can't sing. We don't have choice there, do we? So the eyes of people are blinded if they don't see the truth of the gospel. And this is I could give you an example from one very fine friend of mine who is Jewish, and he and his wife were at a dinner with a couple that invited us, and my wife and me. And this man said to me, you know, we talked to him about the gospel. He said, well, what you're really saying is that you and your wife and Gary and Carol will be in heaven, and Margaret and I will be in hell. Well, of course, we wiggle around, you know, very much. We didn't want to say that flat out, but that is actually the answer. And then my friend said, my Jewish friend has never accepted Christ, but he said the closest he ever came was when he challenged someone on his radio program saying that to him. And the man said, yes, that's true, and began to cry. You know? And that really is true. And it's we find it hard to say flat out, you know, in the face in the social situation. But you've got to tell the truth.
Folks, you can read Dr. Brown's columns for the Religion and Society Report on the web at profam.org. profam.org. Dr. Harold O.J. Brown is professor of theology and philosophy at Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's editor of the Religion and Society Report, and he has an article in a recent issue of the Religion and Society Report titled Idols. Dr. Brown, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being our guest.
Well, thank you. And you can also subscribe to it, to the Religion and Society Report. And that gives us even more pleasure.
It's right there at profam.org. Well, when we come back from this break, we've got Hour 3 of Issues, Etc. ahead. Dr. Jeff Walls joins us. We haven't talked with him for some time. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. We're going to take up the issue of the midterm elections, people expecting big things, big shifts, a change, perhaps a foretaste of things to come in November 2008. So we'll talk about these midterm elections. It does explain one thing, and we've had this from politicians and non-politicians alike on this program. The fact that we're in a midterm election year explains why so little has been happening in Washington. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the war and the midterm elections. That seems to be the biggest issue on people's minds with Dr. Jeff Walls when we come back from this break. We'll spend the last half hour of Issues, Etc. with Dr. David Stevens. He's executive director of the Christian Medical Association in Bristol, Tennessee. Two issues will be our subject. First of all, the president has expressed support for the FDA's decision to allow adult women to purchase Plan B without a prescription. He did that earlier this week in a press conference. We'll find out what Dr. Stevens thinks about that. And also, there's a new report that claims to create stem cells without destroying embryos. It almost sounds too good to be true, but we'll find out whether it is or isn't when we talk with Dr. David Stevens in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Coming up after this break, what will the midterm elections hold for the Senate, the House, and what will those elections mean for the presidential election in 2008? We'll answer all those questions with Dr. Jeff Walls after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.